Hello, I'm Alex Stevenson, and unusually for this, the eighth episode of our mini-series, the Napoleon Movie Quarter Hourly, it's been just 24 hours in real time since James Topham, who knows a thing or two about screenwriting, and I recorded our last episode. Just one day. It's nowhere near enough time for me to sensibly and healthily digest a whole 15 minutes of movie magic, and yet that is what I've done. Potentially sacrificing some of my health for the good of this project. I think a lot of listeners might say that this was not worth it at all. I was thinking because of the quality of the film rather than the quality of this podcast, but each can come to their own conclusion. Nevertheless, the finish line is in sight now, because we're hitting the two-hour mark at the end of this 15 minutes today. This is episode 8 of 10. Which is, yeah, it feels like progress, James.
It does. It does. Yeah. And you've been having a veritable orgy of Napoleon the movie watching over the last 24 hours, Alex. I hope you don't have any serious and ongoing effects from it.
We must trust to hope. But in the meantime, I'm very interested to talk to you about screenwriting theory and technique and practice and how it might explain some of the decisions that have been made in terms of the presentation of this film, which promised so much and has delivered so little.
Well, Alex, always a pleasure to be here with you. And I'd say a seventh of the way through the running time, we are surely, as we said last episode, surely on the cusp of Act 3 now. But what screenwriting theory tells us is that before we can cross the threshold into Act 3, the central character must go through a long night of the soul. They must reach their lowest point and then be reborn with a new understanding of themselves and the world.
And so what I was looking for, or expecting here, was at least 15 minutes on Russia, but we'll see how we get on.
Yeah. Look, I can't, as you know, Alex, I don't know anything about Napoleonic history, but I can't imagine how Napoleon in Russia could possibly lead to a long night of the soul, but...
Well, the key word there, I think, is long. And I was very much expecting, as I say, at least 10 minutes on this. But again, we'll see.
Look, there's no time to do anything in this film, as we've demonstrated. Well, Alonzi, as Joaquin Phoenix might say. So Napoleon reaches Moscow on horseback. There's a lot of CGI Russian buildings in the background, but...
What, CGI?
I think watching him.
They were amazing, those golden domes glimmering in the sunlight.
Do you think they built them?
Surely no expense was spared.
I think they got all the famous Russian buildings all together in the same shot, as if to say, this is all Russia on display.
I see. Okay.
But Moscow is deserted, much to Napoleon's dismay. 300,000 souls lived in the city, he says, and they all just left.
Just to quickly say, I think the horse did the best acting in this 15 minutes, potentially. When it saw a small group of peasants, it did a bit of a jig and looked genuinely alarmed, which was good.
Yeah, I'm sure that was a written jig, no doubt. So Napoleon enters a building, I don't know, let's call it the Kremlin. And a line reminiscent of the, and he says a line reminiscent of the 1970s classic film Warriors. Warriors come out to play. Or, you know, the equivalent of his taunting of the Tsar, which is, come out, I'm just going to give you a little spanking. What do you think of that, Alex? Do you think that's a historically accurate quote?
Well, I think on Kremlin, we don't know for certain it's the Kremlin because they didn't write it on the screen, which I think was a missed opportunity. On spanking, I think he's projecting. I think it's mummy issues again.
Oh, you know what? We haven't had much of in the last half an hour or so, mummy issues. Not since Pregnancy Gate.
Since she became a procuress.
Yes, a pan de ruse. Anyway, Napoleon walks through, let's say, the Kremlin to the Russian throne, which, Alex, we could argue is precisely what he has wanted throughout throughout the film. It's a symbol of him achieving ultimate power in Europe. But he seems very dissatisfied, doesn't he? Why do you think Napoleon seems so down at this moment that should be his ultimate triumph, Alex?
Well, firstly, James, I just ask you whether pandaroos are a cross between pandas and kangaroos. Which could have livened this segment of the film up. I think Napoleon Bonaparte is down at this stage because he's getting his wants and his needs in a tangle, isn't he?
Yes, finally. And this is a classic Long Night of the Soul thematic occurrence. Finally, the hero gets precisely what they want, but it's exactly at that moment when they achieve it that they realise it is not what they need.
Whoa, hang on a second. So actually, this is brilliant filmmaking. Because you've got this entire city as a metaphor for the emptiness of power.
Yes. As he says, and they all just left, which of course could also be true of his ambitions.
I mean, this is actually true, basically. He did not get why this move would be made by the Tsar. Surely they would come to the table like everybody else had done and you would have a negotiated peace and that would be the end of it. But no. And so, actually, this is fairly accurate.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And that night, Napoleon wakes to the noise of CGI Moscow on fire. And when he asks who did it, he's told it's the Russians themselves. And exactly like you say, Alex, he's gobsmacked. He'd rather burn his own city than negotiate with me, he says. And so Napoleon's plan is, okay, well, let's carry on here. Let's march right into the centre of Russia in St. Petersburg.
Which it's up to Berthier to say, not so sure about that.
In my notes, Alex, I've got it as a rando general, because I don't think we've ever seen this guy before.
I think we have seen him before because he was definitely on the Amazon Prime cast notes at the bottom, definitely, when I was pausing this. But and also, it's unacceptable for you not to know who Berthier is, even though you haven't been interested in this period.
So Rando General says, look, Napoleon, marching through the Russian winter is not a great idea. This is not something that Napoleon wants to hear. And we know this because he grabs his hat firmly on his head and shouts "Wah!" a bit like Wario, the villain from the Mario Brothers franchise.
Yes, that's true. But again, my theory is that he's basically a child, a man child, and quite a lot of I think that comes through quite strongly here and in a number of other places. I mean, maybe the conversation between Sir Ridley Scott and Joaquin Phoenix was all about how can you, you've got to get the anger all the way up to 10 out of 10. What are you going to do? I can only give you 1 second to express it. Go, see what you can do.
And then for days and days, Joaquin Phoenix is thinking about, okay, how do I do this? And then he's you know, he says, okay, I'll take a break. I'll go and play Mario Kart 64. And then at the end of the...
I think he was probably working really hard and he'd come up with a... or something a bit more pained, but no, Ridley Scott wanted more.
So, of course, Rando General is right because the Russian...
I just want to apologise to our listeners for James calling Berthier a Rando General. It's not a description or descriptor that I endorse. But carry on, James.
The Russian winter turns out to be cruel indeed. The French army gets snowed on and almost immediately resorts to eating their own horses and cannibalism.
Yeah, it didn't take much, did it?
Did not. I would give it maybe 3 seconds of screen time from the point where the snow starts falling. One of the French...
Would it have been helped, James, if they'd had a thermometer on the left-hand side of the screen and it had just gone...
Or if it had come up in writing, you know, kind of like -4°C.
I bet there's an actor who's been done out of having a line along the lines of... It's a bit parky, isn't it?
Well, there is a great moment where one of the French soldiers is so despondent with the cold and the hunger that he whittles a small wooden pipe and blows tunelessly into it. Can you think of anything worse, Alex, than to be sat on the cold Russian tundra blowing tunelessly into a small wooden pipe?
Well, maybe being the person sitting next to him, but yeah, it's not good, is it? Not good.
He also grows a fabulous moustache in order to keep his upper lip warm, you'll note. So to keep his man's spirits up, Napoleon wanders through the ranks shouting, "We're winning," which, to paraphrase Shania Twain, "Alex, don't impress them much." That does not cut any parsnips for the French troops.
But it is a useful summation of the Moniteur as issued to the troops at the time. You know, that's good PR from Napoleon Bonaparte summed up in a nutshell. And by good, I mean direct and abrupt.
So, what's really interesting to me here at this point is sort of the lesson that Napoleon is taking away from this, his greatest upset to date. He says in a voiceover letter to Josephine, "Your words rattle in my head. I am nothing without you." It seems that Napoleon is blaming his failure on the battlefield on divorcing his wife. Now, I'm not sure that the writing provides much evidence for that as a thematic point. The two things don't seem remotely connected at all. But there is something else thematically interesting here, because he then says, "Fortune has deserted me." We're back to fate, we're back to fortune. You know, what I think we're seeing here is a man who's kind of given himself up to become the embodiment of destiny, of fate, has put his own personal feelings to one side. And then when fate turns on him, he doesn't have, the will or the resources to take fortune back into his own hands.
Now, I've got a deep and meaningful thought here. So my idea about wants and needs is that they flipped over the course of the film. Could we say that at the start of the film, what Napoleon wanted was Josephine, as demonstrated by the chair scraping, etc. But what he needed in that febrile political atmosphere of the French Revolution was to establish himself as an important figure and do well. And the best way of doing that was on the battlefield. And his... Well, okay, because I think that is potentially supported by this screenwriting approach, because he doesn't talk that much about ambition at the start. There's a little bit of it, but not too much. And by this stage of the film, it's very clear that what he needs above all is Josephine. He needs her more than wants her, and he wants her for all time, in the words of Glen Campbell. Okay, that's Wichita Lineman.
In many ways, he is the Wichita Lineman.
He is, isn't he? Yeah. So things have changed. He might feel like he wants to send an army of 500,000 off to Russia, but that's not really what's important to him at this stage.
Yeah, I think the important thing is that he is starting to come to a self-realization, Alex. He realizes that what he'd wanted previously isn't what he needed. And that's, I think, that in a nutshell is how you sum up the passage into Act 3. Act 3 is all about self-knowledge. It's all about knowing who you are. And I think what we're saying is Napoleon now knows that despite all his martial glory, all his belief that he is an instrument of fate, actually it's his more personal needs that are the thing that fulfill him.
So we're really properly here realising what the filmmakers were up to, what the screenwriters were up to in trying to come up with a great film. Only for some reason it didn't quite come across at the movie theatre.
No, I guess you just need to watch it very, very slowly to get there, Alex. So look, I think we're at the all is lost moment, right? And we may be on the verge of Act 3, because as Napoleon returns to receive the news that, because of the gigantic losses he's incurred on the march home, he is to be exiled. And who delivers this important news, Alex? None other than your friend and mine, the sinister butler from the recent 2023 motion picture, Saltburn. He's back.
He's back. He is my favourite. Talleyrand is the best. And I thoroughly approve of this portrayal of him.
Talleyrand. And on and on and on. Because unlike my favourite, Mark Bonner, who has completely disappeared from this film without a trace, Saltburn Butler has clung on in there right into the third act.
I've got bad news for you, James. I'm afraid things didn't work out for Juno.
What?
It's probably for the... Yeah, I'm sorry. They couldn't have had him in at this... Well, they could have done. They could have done. They did what they liked.
I think once you've cast Mark Bonner, then you use him, you know, whenever you can.
But we've seen that a lot with so many interesting characters that appear for a moment and then off they go. Thank goodness for Ben Miles.
Yeah, he's a real backbone throughout this piece.
And yet, we didn't see a scene that I was really properly looking forward to for some time, which is basically Napoleon Bonaparte. He goes on ahead of his army. He leaves it, abandoning it again. And so he's in a sledge with none other than Ben Miles / Caulaincourt.
Wow.
For ages. They could have had a great time.
That would have been...
being miserable together. And yet, again, that's something we were robbed of in this.
Maybe that's something for the four-hour TV special.
Fingers crossed!
So, it could be worse, this exile. Napoleon's put in charge of an entire island, but more importantly, one feels from the screenplay, the settlement protects Josephine's land and income. And this is a key factor in his decision to abdicate. He says, "I loved France too much." Self-justifying nonsense, Alex? Or is this a new understanding of himself and the world that we'd expect from a man on the cusp of Act Three?
Oh, well, when you put it like that, it makes me wonder, but I was definitely going to go with self-justifying nonsense.
It can be both. As we know, Alex, when we move into a new act, we cross a threshold, and the threshold that Napoleon is crossing here is the sea to the lovely island of Elba, which seems a jolly nice place, full of cheerful, smiling peasants.
There was a visual reminder of him bouncing around on that donkey in Toulon right at the start. There he is on his horse, doink, 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 and now he's reduced to just having a small little band of uniformed accompaniers. But, you know, he's not up to much anymore. He seems kind of almost wistful, I suppose, resigned to his fate, fairly relaxed.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. He seems a man in much more control and awareness of himself. But your point around his small retinue is very useful. There's an interesting contrast when we cross-cut from Elba to a much larger, more impressive train of horses, this time approaching Malmaison, Josephine's house. And who should be visiting Alex but...
Who?
That fucking Tsar Alexander. The cheek,
no.
Alex.
Oh,
the
no.
Cheek.
I'll have to put the explicit thing on the podcast again.
I'm sorry. Maybe you can bleep it. As though burning Moscow is not enough, the Tsar has turned up and it seems is trying to set Josephine's fragile heart alight.
Well, her bosom had been largely covered up for most of the previous hour.
I'm glad you're keeping a track of that, Alex.
Yeah, I think it's fairly straightforward in a sense that it is suggestive. I'll just leave it there, I suppose.
Look, we can only assume that Josephine isn't entirely resistant to the Tsar's attentions because they end up doing what sort of a creepy, weird dance in a seemingly deserted ballroom.
It's only one step or two away from the tango, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah. There's something. It's a very charged dance. But the ballroom couldn't have been entirely deserted, Alex, because a newspaper illustrator was clearly present. He was scrawling a picture of this scene for the following day's press. And Napoleon, who you can only assume has kind of wandered down to the local Elba newsagent to get the national French papers that morning, is faced with another unfortunate headline.
Here we go. It's time for another angry opportunity.
So the headline is Boney's old bird caught out of the nest again. You can only imagine the screenwriter's cackle of joy at discovering that in the archive. Yes. And Napoleon's reaction is...
why, you dirty rat?
He's not happy. There's a lot of smashing of the newspaper against tables.
Again, it's very condensed. It's just a second of pure rage. Again, could have been a shaken fist, but no. Yeah, Joaquin Phoenix felt he needed more.
It's the shaken fist is sorely lacking throughout the entirety of this. But we've still got 45 minutes to go, Alex. So who's to say?
Sheesh. But given the emphasis that was placed on Josephine as being Napoleon Bonaparte's main motivation in Napoleon hot-footing it from Egypt in the first act of the film, here we are again, and surely we're left wondering that this must be the reason why he would attempt to do something rash now.
So I don't know how historically accurate that is, Alex, that the Russian Tsar might be, that Napoleon's return was entirely driven by his concern about the Russian Tsar nobbling his ex-wife. Feels a little bit EastEnders.
Napoleon remained on Elba less than a year. Louis XVIII was on the throne of France, and everywhere disbanded soldiers were wishing that the little corporal would come back and lead them to fresh victories. Then, suddenly and unexpectedly, he came. No reason given, according to the only history book we're using for this purpose. So who knows?
It's entirely shrouded in the mists of history, unfortunately.
Alas.
But Josephine is given word by Napoleon that he's on his way back. And she replies with a line so horribly bad it could only have been taken from real life, I'm afraid. She writes, "Napoleon, I'm a flower that opens its petals and smiles to the sunshine, unconscious that the storm is near, which will lay me low and scatter my leaves." That, I'm afraid, is what we call in the screenwriting trade a stinker, with, of course, any apologies to the film screenwriters if they've written it themselves.
Yeah, not too much to say about that. It's the kind of line that goes straight over my head when I hear it. I just don't absorb it at all. It may be some kind of self-protection mechanism.
Yeah. This film must feel like it's 7 minutes long to you in some ways. So Napoleon returns home. He kisses the French beach, classic returning home gesture. But as he approaches, it seems that Josephine has fallen ill. The doctor says she should go to bed, but she says Napoleon is coming. He unexpectedly came, Alex.
He did, as was said in the book.
What's a girl to do in this situation? Well, the answer is wait, because Napoleon, who in this film so far has dashed from Toulon to Egypt to Russia in what seems like the wink of an eye, proceeds to walk extremely slowly across what feels like every field in France.
Well, yeah, he's going slowly.
He's going at an absolutely glacial pace, which is fortunate because it gives Josephine's condition just enough time to deteriorate dangerously.
Yeah, it's time for that doctor to come back and put his... No, I won't finish that sentence.
It's good to see Kevin Eldon back in the mix. Meanwhile, soldiers are dashing at a significantly higher speed to tell the news of Napoleon's return to someone. We assume he's a recently rethroned king, but for reasons beyond my ken, there's no on-screen title for Louis XVIII. We just have to make a guess at who he is. He is, however, played by the incomparable Ian McNeice, so that's something at least.
And it is a good performance. He's up against Orson Welles here in the from the Waterloo movie, who's playing the equivalent part. And I think he does a pretty good job compared to the great Orson Welles. You know, he's certainly keeping pace with him, despite only really having one or two facial expressions to deploy. But no, he does a good job, I'd say.
As an aside, we should do that film as our next special podcast, Alex. We should go 15 minutes by 15 minutes through that.
Oh, God.
Louis is told that Napoleon is marching towards Paris, and just as we tick over to the two-hour mark, the point at which most respectable films would be wrapping up, this one, like Napoleon, continues to march on. The general is met by a brigade of French soldiers who command him to surrender. And for those keeping count, it is exactly at this moment that I woke up in the cinema and said to my companions, "Oh, no, did I miss Elba?" And I had, indeed, miss the entirety, both of Moscow and Napoleon's exile.
You must have thought you'd been asleep for, God, an hour, 2 hours, given how much history had happened.
Oh, well, look, I'd seen so much of the way that the previous historical events had been treated, Alex, that I pretty much assumed that I'd just close my eyes briefly.
Fair enough. And that, I think, brings us to the two-hour mark.
Yep, it certainly does. Wow, what a journey.
What a critical transition from Act 2 to Act 3 it's been. It's the most exciting transition of all.
Certainly is. And look, Alex, as far as I'm concerned, I'm a flower that opens its petals and smiles to the sunshine, unconscious that you are near. You will lay me low and scatter my leaves.
Okay. There was a little bit of me that was thinking about just clarifying that that we're both heterosexual and married, but I didn't think it quite right to include that. Still, I'm going to conclude by saying thank you, James. And if I ever read anything about the Tsar, let's say, dancing with my wife, I'll probably do a little something like this.